Know that there will be coffee at the break. I know that you're all desperate. We are blaming this on AAAS. It is clearly their fault. They have some odd rule about you can't come in here and spill coffee on the seats, and therefore but all of you can rush towards that exit at the end of this session and fill your veins with caffeine. I thought ahead, so I just hope you're going to be all right during this. So here's the order of things. I will speak very briefly. Then I'm going to pass this off to Boots Castle, who is head of the policy committee. And she and her gang, the standing committee chairs, are going to do a rapid presentation of what they have been doing in the last year and invite you to a standing committee session this afternoon. You can choose which one you'd like to go to, and we hope that you will go and be part of that. And then Dan Atkins, whom I know you're all looking forward to hearing, will make his presentation, and we'll have an opportunity for questions, and I hope you'll be thinking about what you'd like to ask him during that session. You know, we usually get up at this point in our annual meeting and show PowerPoints. I mean, what is it that our culture demands that one have PowerPoints? So I'm defying the culture and saying no PowerPoints this year, because where we are in the development of NSDL, I think, is at a point of convergence where we just don't want to say, well, we did this, and we did that, and we did the other thing, and here's what we're getting ready for. But what we see coming together, I think, is a very important educational community. Yes, Fedora is that far, right, Dean, from being up and public, and we know that that will have enormous power for us. We are that far, I think, coming from the Pathways meeting yesterday afternoon, from realizing all the benefits of community sign-on across core integration and the Pathways grants and others. So a lot going on in the technical side. We see the power, really the enormous power in NSDL, of the strategic partnership. The organizations that are in the Pathways, and the Pathways themselves, you know, are aggregations of partners. No one is more stunning in the amount of aggregation than Ben itself here at AAAS, which had a legendary budget of 75 pages. I think everybody ended up getting 13 cents in that grant, but it seems to be working out for them. The power of these strategic partnerships, when you look at the Pathways, those organizations within the Pathways have well over a million members among themselves. So we see all of this beginning to cohere and beginning to come together. So what I want to say today is what NSDL is about is this endless dream of education that we all have. You know, Aristotle wrote in the Metaphysics, all men, and unfortunately he meant men, but I'm sure he would be more enlightened now, all men by nature desire to know. All men by nature desire to know. It is the premise on which our whole civilization, our particular civilization made for us by the Enlightenment, is put together. And what NSDL hopes to do is to pull together those opportunities to learn, with the technology in back of it in which so many of you have been involved, but with the services and tools and materials that mean somebody in a third grade in North Dakota has a chance to do a very, very good job for the pupils whom she is teaching. There's a wonderful poem of Wallace Stevens called The Poems of Our Climate, and it's a wonderful piece, but he has a line in there where he says, "The imperfect is our paradise." It's a wonderful line. And when you think about it, those of us who are in education, all of us in this room trying to pull together this particular educational phenomenon, it is that sort of quest for the perfection of education in the imperfection of our own lives that we are all engaged in. He talks about the ever restless mind. And all of those of you who have been involved in the sausage making of NSDL know how restlessness can be as we have worked, all of us, at putting this together. So it's coming together, and it's coming together as a very powerful instrument of the technology in back of it, the education in front of it, all serving this incredibly important mission of education. Report after report after report, how important this is. So what we all know in this room today is that to be part of that is probably one of the most wonderful things that one can imagine. So I thank you for all these years when we've been working to put this together. We're in a transition year in 07 to the next stage of NSDL, and I am completely confident that that next stage is really a gift to the nation, and it's a gift that all of you have given. So with that, let me introduce Boots Castle.
Sorry, I resumed to PowerPoint.
It's not quite working.
On behalf of the Policy Committee, I want to welcome everybody to the annual meeting. The Policy Committee is the community elected arm of the NSDL, and that has some significance as we go along. This is a brief list of, well, it is the list of the official members of the Policy Committee. You can also find them at the webpage. I won't talk more about that, but I did want to make sure that the names got up in front of you once. Again, I'm not going to go through the charter, just mentioning that it's there. Again, it's at the NSDL webpage, but its policy, its purpose is to advise the core integration team, the grantees, kind of bring the community together and organize some efforts to make some things happening. And a really important part of that has to do with the standing committees, and we'll give most of our brief time to the standing committees. I do want to mention, though, that membership on the policy committee is elected by the community, and that it is an annual event, and the election begins at the annual meeting. So we will be in the process of acquiring new members during this meeting. I go off the policy committee this year, as well as several other people. We need replacements. So please think about what you would like to do in terms of being part of the policy committee. We will be tapping people on shoulders and looking for recruits, if not volunteers. Please nominate yourself or someone else. There will be a box at the registration desk to take those nominations. Please give that some thought. The standing committees of the NSDL are really action groups that bring together members of the Pathways projects, but also members of other projects that have been deeply involved in the evolution of the NSDL since the very beginning. There are five standing committees at the present time, and what we're going to do is have a Minuteman-ish kind of introduction to the current activities of the policy committee and of the standing committees. And I really want to emphasize that these are the real action groups of this organization, and that they are open to new members, and that they have a lot of interesting and exciting things happening, and really encourage you to go to one of the standing committee meetings that are happening today. They all are at the same time, so you have to pick one. But if you're interested in more than one, go to one and then communicate with the leadership of more than one to get involved in those activities. So I'm going to ask the standing committee chairs to stand up over here. Get ready. And we're going to do these in alphabetical order by the committee name. So starting with community services. Thank you.
Hello. So the main activity of the community services over the past year were these tool times. They're online conferences. They're a way for especially people with services to advertise those services to the whole community. But we're also open for other uses of these. You can view them as extending the annual meeting into the year. So we're looking for people who are willing to volunteer to give one on their work. We also like to try bringing in external speakers this time. So if anyone has suggestions for who they'd like to hear in an online conference, please let us know. We also coordinate with the outreach efforts of NSDL. And so the meeting this afternoon will probably mostly be focused on that aspect. So if you want to learn more about what Susan Van Gundy is doing in outreach, and she started these campaigns, which are very interesting. She has a lot of great ideas for that are in ongoing campaigns, and we're interested in brainstorming on other things we can do for the outreach efforts.
Hi, I'm Kim Lytle. I'm with the Middle School Portal at Ohio State University, and I'm the chair of the Content Standing Committee. We're going to meet in Revell at 12:45. I would encourage anybody that's interested in metadata and metadata generation and sharing metadata to come join us. The first topic of discussion is going to be the metadata registry. We're going to get an update on that and see what vocabularies are in the registry and see how we can participate and help that project. We're also going to talk about automatic metadata generation, a little bit about IVIA data fountains. There were three metadata fields that were talked about in the Pathways meeting yesterday, trying to get some consensus on if they're required, if they're not required, what are the controlled vocabularies that we should be using, and so we also want to help get that discussion started, and that's learning resource type, audience, and grade level. Please join us. Bye.
Good morning. On behalf of my cohorts in crime, Flora McMartin, who's vice chair, Ann Diekema, who is co-chair, and Mick Koo, who is CI evaluator, we'd like to talk briefly about some of the things EIESC has been involved with. Many of you know and responded to an online evaluation survey that we conducted in the spring, and then we recently sent out a draft report based on that evaluation. In addition, there was an evaluation pathways meeting held this past spring summer that was organized by Flora McMartin and Sarah Gersh, and we'll be talking about that. And then finally, we started some beginning discussions with an international digital library evaluation group. Today we're going to be having, we encourage you to grab your lunch at 12:15, your box lunch, bring it over to Abelson, and EIESC will be meeting there and then running into our meeting times to talk about all of these items. In addition, then at 4 o'clock in Ravel, we'll be having a community discussion with, again, continued presentations on the evaluation survey report and the Pathways meeting. So we hope to see you at one of those and hopefully at both. Thanks.
The Sustainability Standing Committee has the task of considering strategies to bring the NSDL into the future. There are several items that we have been doing over the last several years, and we've evolved to the point where we're considering what are the common elements of digital libraries in general. We've identified five common elements that are involved with the NSDL as well as other digital libraries to create functional frameworks for the public good. Libraries are built in the public good to create valued collections and services, and emphasis on the notion of value in terms of user communities that have an interest in supporting those collections and services into the future. Resilient public and private partnerships, in the sense that NSDL itself is one among many digital libraries that's emerging, and it's necessary to create partnerships, strategic and otherwise, to facilitate its longevity. Effective preservation of digital objects is another component of sustainability. Without the effective migration of information today into the future, the effort of digital libraries is only a static effort. And practical revenue generating activities. NSDL itself is a new culture in the sense of the National Science Foundation, and we need to think broadly about how to move the NSDL into the future. On Friday, the closing session of the NSDL meeting will be a discussion on the development of a task force on digital library sustainability. The purpose of this task force originated with the idea that there are these common elements of digital libraries, and digital library programs in large have been considering sustainability efforts in parallel, and that there is a need to consider how to bring these different digital library programs into a more unified, synergistic realm. So the idea of a task force would facilitate these types of digital library discussions. So at the heart of this is digital libraries. In a sense, these digital libraries have the need to create added value to digital information, ultimately to empower a culture of education. This is the model that we're all talking about in terms of using our newly evolved world of digital information to empower this education culture. But this wheel doesn't turn by itself. There needs to be a force behind it. So the emphasis in terms of sustainability is to establish innovative business and organizational models. There was a meeting last week at Emory University that focused on these, on sustainability. Among the interesting components is that digital libraries are part of an ecosystem, and that the sustainability, the stability of the ecosystem is in part related to the interconnections among its various elements. So I would encourage you to contribute to the discussions. They've been active. There will be the meeting today after lunch, and there will be the discussion at the end of this meeting. Thank you very much.
Hi, folks. Good morning. My name is Martin Halbert from Emory University. I'm the vice chair, outgoing vice chair of the Technology Standing Committee, together with Ed Almasy of the AMSR project, and Robbie Robson is the chair of the Standing Committee. I'm also the incoming chair of the Policy Committee, so I will be transitioning out of this role. Technology Standing Committee is very interested in sharing information about interoperability across NSDL projects. We've done various programs in the past around different topics in this area. We have done some work around service registries, and we're very interested in fostering the adoption of the single sign-on process among NSDL projects. We're very interested in working with core integration in both testing and trying out the metadata repository in ways. And we also want to draw your attention to this wonderful list that Karen Henry has just done of common NSDL technologies. And we'll be talking about that a little bit at the meeting today at 12:45. I do want to mention we are recruiting new members, new officers as well. So please, if you're interested in technology across NSDL projects, come to our meeting and we'll see you then. Thanks.
Thank you very much to all the group and to everybody for being here. And now happy to turn it over to Luzia.
In the future, right, digital paper, the PowerPoint will be right here, and I'll just, it's coming soon to a theater near you. Just a couple of quick remarks. First, thank you for coming. It's a little less than a year since we last met. It feels sort of odd to be meeting in October. I sort of think November, you know, NSDL. But thanks to AAAS for hosting the meeting, Shirley and Yolanda. In fact, the last time I think I was in this auditorium, I was with a small planning group of AAAS and other their member organizations, looking at digital libraries and you know, sort of building some capacity amongst AAAS membership, and the BEN project is a wonderful outgrowth of that. Before I introduce Dan, I just have a couple of quick remarks I'll add. This is an incredibly exciting time for education, and in particular technology in education. Now, you know, you've probably heard that a gazillion times. Just about any time seems to be a really exciting time. Now it's even more so. But I'd say that right now there's several markers that I would just offer, just off the top of my head. Going from a fairly sort of a global kind of context and environment to a very specific new development. The first is that, as you know, there's intense political pressure right now, the context of globalization and competitiveness and so forth. I personally find the competitiveness discussion to be a bit jingoistic, but that's the way it is right now. However you call it, the conditions are extremely compelling. So that's political pressure within the United States, and we stand poised to be able to really contribute to that and help and offer good solutions. So that's something that I think we should take advantage of. There's a lot of other foundation support in the nonprofit sector. Some of you are connected with the Hewlett Foundation work. They're very interested in open education resources. Sun is also interested. Scott McNeely in particular is looking for what he's going to do in his next life. And he's really pushing the global education learning community. Some of you I know are involved in that. And so there is a more of that global context that's has a lot of interest and is offering opportunities for us. The MacArthur Foundation, so here's the third marker. Today, in about 50 minutes, there's going to be a live webcast where the MacArthur Foundation is announcing $50 million of grants to a variety of institutions. I don't know a whole lot about their particular procedure. Like the Genius Grants, I think they probably just went out and just identified a bunch of places. But I think that that's going to be very interesting to see. These are grants to support the explorations into the use and research and the impact of technology on education. Primarily, I think right now they're focusing on K-12. But it'll be very interesting to track the progress of those. That's a significant sum of money. Again, it plays into this sort of larger political setting. And the fourth marker, I don't quite know how to think about this, but I just know that it's important. Reuters.com has opened up a bureau in Second Life. Go to secondlife.reuters.com, because the virtual economy in Linden dollars is traded via several currency exchanges to U.S. dollars. There are millions of U.S. dollars in transactions every month. I heard a report that there's a woman who's making several hundred thousands of dollars, U.S. We're talking about real money, and she's a real estate mogul in Second Life. So things are happening out there that surely have an effect on education, because it's the kids who are in the learners, and they're not just kids, the learners in those environments are learning something. It's affecting them, and they're going to bring that into the real world. But then we might be able to learn something in that virtual world. It's hugely exciting. I don't know what the effects are going to be. They could be really non-existent. They could be huge. But we should stay tuned to that. Anyway, it is an exciting time. I'm delighted that NSDL has the opportunity to be involved in that. And I think a key piece of that involvement from NSF's point of view is cyber infrastructure. And we're very happy that we have Dan Atkins here to have some plenary remarks and then a Q&A, and I'll be moderating that. I would encourage you to think about some questions during the remarks. We've had some questions submitted ahead of time, and we'll sort of play on those for the discussion. Just a quick set of remarks about Dan. He's the perfect person. NSF is very fortunate to have Dan as the head of the new Office for Cyber Infrastructure. He was, as many of you know, the chair of the advisory committee that put together what has become known as the Atkins Report, but this was the report on cyber infrastructure that was commissioned by Rujana Baja and the SIES Directorate at NSF. It's been very, very influential. Dan has enormous experience in a variety of areas, high-performance computer architectures, algorithms, more recently a lot of work in collaboratories, and that interest in the intersection of human, social, and technical infrastructure plays right into the kinds of things that NSDL is all about. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dan, and look forward to the remarks, and we'll have an interesting Q&A. Thanks.
Had ironically interoperability problems at the National Academies. At the American. So I have. I don't know if I can give this probably without slides, but I did export my keynote presentation to. You want to. See if you can open that PDF that's on the.
This one.
Yeah.
Is that yours?
This PDF app has a presentation mode. Maybe it'll work.
Thank you.
Is that in presentation mode? No, I don't think so. Is it? All right. Let's see. All right, we'll just try this.
See, the perfect person to be the head of the Office of Cyber.
It looks like it may be cutting off a little bit. Okay, well, I am pleased to be here. And I want to talk a little bit about the NSF CI vision and activities. It's been quickly evolving, and so you may not be quite up to speed on that. I then want to dare to share with you some thoughts on the accomplishments and the future of the NSDL. It's something I've been kind of peripherally involved in off and on since its inceptions, including some of the early workshops, I think, that Bill Arms and others put together where the idea was generated. And then hopefully allow some time for questions and discussions. I just got back. Does anyone know if there's actually a presentation mode that takes up the whole screen here?
Control L.
Ah, thank you. All right.
Who was that?
All you need is one bit of information, right? I just got back from a speaking tour in Europe, and I am conscious of the nomenclature issues. And in Europe, the term e-science, or more generally e-research, or e-infrastructure being used. And here, I think Ruzhina gets the credit for coining this hard-to-say word, cyber infrastructure, which thankfully has now been bridged to CI, at least in NSF world. And so we need to talk about CI enhanced or CI enabled in some cases, science and engineering. And we're talking about science and engineering and research and learning in the same breath at NSF these days. And there's a strong belief that cyber infrastructure, the investments we're making, need to have a dual payoff in both areas and hopefully in new synergies between the two for more authentic, inquiry-based, hopefully passion-driven learning. It's also being viewed as relevant to rapid response to natural and man-made issues, to the humanities. And on the left, you see the bills that I had in here aren't working, so you get to see the whole thing at one time. The ACLS report, which you're probably familiar with, and the emerging Haystack community of CI and the humanities. And there has been, for some years now, forums under the National Academies, under the OECD in Europe, or internationally, looking at the implications of cyber infrastructure for the very nature and the conduct of the mission of the university of the future. And around that are emerging concepts of meta-universities or world universities. In Asia, the term cyber science is being used. So I want to point out that there are these dualities that cyber infrastructure enables research and development, but it also needs to be an object of research and development. It is one that facilitates the appropriate use of cyber infrastructure, can greatly facilitate collaboration, particularly over distance and time, but it requires a new wave of collaboration to achieve the vision and impact that it offers us. And with respect to learning and education, cyber infrastructure is both an enabler and also needs to address the workforce and issues of educating people to use and apply and create cyber environments. This is the report that Lee mentioned. I trust you're mostly familiar with that. And that since the essential finding of that report was that we were at an inflection point due to the coincidence of the push of technology and the pull and needs of the science and engineering research communities. It led to, I think, 30-some, probably approaching 40 now, disciplinary workshops in and around the NSF. Most of those are available through the OCI website I'll point you to in a moment. It led to a variety of internal studies which gave rise to the document called the NSF Cyber Infrastructure Vision for 21st Century Discovery. It led to a coordinating entity called the CI Council, where all of the directors of the offices and the directorates of NSF under the chair of Arden Bement personally meet almost weekly for coordination of the cyber infrastructure activities, and the formation of this new office, which is up at the same level as a directorate and reports directly to the director, as well as an external advisory group of prominent people who will be having their second meeting about 2 weeks from now. The framework that's come out of this visioning document is high-performance computing, data analysis and visualization, virtual organizations, and learning and workforce development. All directorates are participating. in the cyber infrastructure activity. And as I said, there's an increasing focus on integrated research and education, and of course, the role of cyber infrastructure in broadening access and participation, democratization. Some of the science drivers for this vision are the inherent complexity and multi-scale nature of today's frontier science challenges, and associated with that, an increasing requirement, not just a nice-to-have, for multidisciplinary, multi-investigator, multi-institutional approaches, the increasing level of data from simulations, digital instrumentation, sensor networks, observatory, the increasing value of data and thus the demand for more systematic curation, preservation, and stewardship, the exploiting of infrastructure for achieving sharing and better stewardship of research funding, and probably most germane to this community, strategic need for providing more people high-quality, authentic science and engineering education and learning opportunities, and I would argue open learning opportunities. And I'll say a bit more about that. So this is kind of a model of what we have in mind. We have computational resources, including on the drawing board now a petascale computing. We have data and information management resources, such as those provided by the NSDL. We have interfaces to the physical world through sensing, observation, and activation. We have these in distributed and in heterogeneous formats all over the world. And the goal stuff in the middle is the middleware or mechanisms for flexibly and securely coordinating these resources and bringing them together in the service of individuals and institutions. And then the rubber hits the road at the interface level for interaction, workflow, visualization, collaboration for distributed teams and environments which are tailored and made specific to a particular community of practice. And ultimately, I would say this, perhaps rather than saying science-driven, as I said a few moments ago, the correct emphasis should be on scientist-driven people to support people engaged in discovery and learning as individuals and as in teams. And these virtual organizations are being built at an increasing rate by many communities of practice, and they've adopted a whole host of names for these. Collaboratory, where the traditions out of which I come, the grid communities, networks, portals, gateways, hubs, virtual research environments, cyber infrastructure collaborative, and I'm sure there are others being used that I don't know of. The scope of activities at NSF around cyber infrastructure includes these three, and this Bromian ring construct, which many of you have seen me use in the past, is a symbol of the peer-to-peer synergy, mutually beneficial synergy, and alignment that I believe is required to come anywhere close to achieving the vision. The OCI has major responsibility for provisioning, creation, deployment, and operation of advanced cyber infrastructure, particularly components or resources that are shared or facilities for sharing, a la middleware. But all the directorates are engaged in transformative application to enhance discovery and learning. And there's also, of course, a broad spectrum of technical and social research underway that ultimately needs to be harvested and the fruits of that moved into the next generation of the cyber infrastructure. So that's the kind of interplay that's suggested by this Bromian ring. And the Office of Cyber Infrastructure provides these shared resources, as well as increasingly is playing a role in catalyzing this Bromian ring arrangement across the entire foundation. So the estimate of 07 is about $600 million is going into the CI activities, 182 of that in OCI, and the remainder are distributed across the directorates. This is the URL for our website. I'd encourage you to look at it often for new solicitations, for additions to the reports on cyber infrastructure, and particularly if you haven't done so, have a look at this emerging document called Cyber Infrastructure Vision for 21st Century Discovery. There's a new strategic plan out from NSF. It's short, but quite well written and quite interesting, and I would encourage you to read that. And you'll see in it, woven through it, many direct and indirect calls for adoption of cyber infrastructure and its use within research and education. I've left the PDF of these slides on this USB device that's here, and maybe if someone wants to take that and make it available on the web. Now, I'm going to run real quickly through these four components of the vision. High-performance computing is an increasingly important tool in the understanding of life, matter, society, the environment. And NSF is pursuing a multi-tiered or multi-track approach. There's a level of capability that we're assuming the campuses will provide for themselves. Then NSF is investing heavily in a track two or mid-range, with resources largely being aggregated and made available through the TerraGrid. And as I just said, we have initiated a four-year project to acquire a machine that will be capable of sustained petaflop computation and be online by about 2010-2011. And we've just made an award on the Track 2. The first of the Track 2 awards has been made to Texas. On the data side, as I just say very briefly, that there's a growing demand for more systematic curation, interoperability, stewardship of scientific data, and under the direction of Chris Greer, who's actually here. Chris, where are you? We're developing approaches to that activity and to begin moving forward on the recommendations or in the vision within that report. Virtual organizations, as I said, there's increasing communities that are finding it essential to distribute their work, to aggregate resources, people, and information, to relax constraints of distance and time. One way of viewing that is that if you look at the simple matrix of place and time, that much of what we do within the academic world, for example, has historically resided in the upper left quadrant, the same time, same place, or maybe the same place at different times. We have now mediated and supported, platformed by cyber infrastructure, the potential to do knowledge-based activities collaboratively by traversing all four of these quadrants. And it's part of our challenge to figure out how to do that. And for knowledge-intensive organizations, it's competitive. They definitely need to understand the implications of these new degrees of freedom to remain competitive and to better carry out their missions. Just a slide to, again, illustrate that virtual organizations and built on cyber infrastructure are increasingly the norm within the NSF research community. But the technology alone will not achieve the impact. We really need a socio-technical approach, realizing the potential of E or cyber science or CI-enabled science to support effective virtual organizations requires attention to the sociology and to the institutional infrastructure. We need more than good technology and tools. Technology determinism will not do it alone. No less important is the institutional context, the norms of practice and rules to facilitate the collaboration within the science and technology research communities. The institutional and the organizational environment of e-science encompasses a wide and diverse array of integrated social, economic, legal factors, and these need to be taken into account in the design of effective virtual organizations. Of course, underlying this is the rich and increasingly ubiquitous national and international networking that NSF has led and continues to support. The GRID movement, and I think it's important to note that it's really a movement, it's not a specific technology. The TerraGrid, now the Open Science Grid, the European equivalent of the EGGE, the Enabling Grid for E-Science, are all important developments. And all of them, I think, are aspiring to attract more resources to them and integrate more resources for the end user, including possibly aspects of the NSDL. I mentioned and I showed my slide on virtual organizations that one of the names people are using are science gateways. that's the name being used within the TerraGrid community, and there are large and growing numbers of science gateways being built within that community. The NICE grid, I'm just going to flip through these very quickly. BERN, a biomedical collaboratory headed by Mark Ellisman, which has been around long enough that actually some scientific home runs have been hit in this community that probably would not have been hit without the cyber infrastructure platform. The GEON project, the lead project on turbulent weather prediction. The BioPortal Nano Hub is a project that I was briefed on a couple of weeks ago. It's actually a very interesting case study on the integration of research and education in CI-enabled environments. I encourage you to have a look at it on their website. X-ray crystallography, ServoGrid, Gene Grid, bioinformatics, and on and on. Now, this is a slide that was actually used by Mario Capilagro, that's roughly my equivalent within the European Commission, in a briefing he gave in Geneva a couple weeks ago, talking about the Framework 7, which is now being rolled out. And the first part, two of his slides I'm going to show you. The first is that the European community is looking at the interplay between education, innovation, and research in a very strategic way. And they are looking at virtual organizations as an important strategy to achieve competitive advantage in doing that. This is a slide that he showed about virtual organizations, and as he was showing this slide, he said that this was a key part of their strategy to lead the world in innovation, research, and education. Finally, on the learning and workforce development side, as I implied earlier, we're talking here both about learning supported by cyber infrastructure as well as workforce development to create and use cyber infrastructure for science and engineering research and education. All of us, of course, are excited about the potential to broaden participation, to exploit new opportunities that cyber infrastructure brings for people who, because of physical capabilities, location, or history, have been excluded from the frontiers of science and engineering research and education, and to explore CI in the context of integrated research and education. Well, with that overview, I want to just conclude by giving you a kind of a outsider's view of what I think some of your accomplishments are. I think NSDL is a cyber infrastructure initiative. Infrastructure, as we're using it at NSF, is not just boxes and wires. It's technology together with content, people, and services. I think you've built, as opening remarks, I think, reinforced, a diverse and complementary kind of a Bromian ring, people with different goals but coming together and finding mutual self-interest in working together. I think you've done that both. You've built an interesting, diverse community both in the doing or the making of the NSDL, and I suspect the NSDL itself has served as a catalyst for among the users of NSDL, and that teachers and educators and others have now formed collaboratives of various sorts, perhaps have never actually physically met, but are routinely collaborating in and around the artifacts available to them through the NSDL. You've made applied contributions to the digital library field and to technologies, particularly open source technologies, and I think in the current content of the NSDL, you have broadened the notion of library content from information to also support of participation through online laboratories, interactive virtual environments, and so forth. So I would say, in a sense, you're supporting learning about or explicit learning as well as learning to be, the more tacit part. Some trends that I would argue, and Anne Lee has actually touched on some of these, that I think are relevant in the NSDL and that you're probably tracking, but if you're not, you should be, in the sense of figuring out what you want to be when you grow up and where you go next. The open education, or what some of us are actually starting to call the open learning resources movement, probably started by the Hewlett and Mellett Foundation and the open courseware investment to MIT, but that has become a large consortium, and the notion of resource is now being extended from course material to, for example, online laboratories, and in fact the entire kind of participatory experience that one would have available through a functionally complete collaboratory. The notions of reuse, remix, and mashup in the current culture, I think, are important and have strong learning implications. More integration or dual use or requirement of dual outcome of these investments in discovery and learning based upon CI platforms, the honoring of legitimate peripheral participation through these environments, the creation of portals into the same underlying virtual resources that can be scaffolded in different ways to support different constituencies, different levels of learning, different levels of experience. The blurring of formal and informal learning through things such as the NSDL. I would say that we're on a threshold where it actually makes sense to start thinking about education as traditionally more of an authority-based activity, and to also honor and learn more about and try to encourage the more passion-based learning that comes from tinkering and amateurism, the kinds of things that John Seely Brown has been talking about. And along those lines, to honor and support collaborations between professionals and amateurs. There's some amazing stories in the astronomy community now where there's this bottom-up astronomy community of amateurs doing incredible distributed but coordinated observations, sometimes finding objects which are then being used to steer the Hubble telescope for a deeper look. And as Lee implied, the look carefully at and learn more about what's going on in the gaming world, the virtual reality world, the massively multiplayer world. Another part of the Second Life story recently is that there's the people that are making money, including money in the real world, out of creating and selling rare real estate, places with great views of the sea and so forth. But then a clever guy came along recently and was just quietly buying up these pieces of land that were kind of infinitely long and very narrow. And nobody quite noticed that until he proceeded to mount these mile-high billboards around these prime real estates and then very willingly, of course, sell those land to the people whose views have been blocked, but at much higher prices than they paid for them. Opportunities, well, those would include, I would say, partnering or being service providers within this emergent OER movement. And by, I think places like Hewlett and others that are making these investments are beginning to worry about who is going to take long-term stewardship for these open objects and how are they going to be organized and what kind of infrastructure that they and others need to invest in. Very, very similar to the issues that you're wrestling with on the NSDL. Maybe there's some chance to come together on that. Partner with this Science Gateway movement for discovery across the NSF learning communities. It's from what I know about your Pathways initiatives, I think there's some commonality there that could be exploited more formally. Look for more integration with the TerraGrid or the Open Science Grid. As I said, there will be initiatives around data stewardship coming from the OCI. Or under the leadership of the OCI, they'll involve the entire spectrum of NSF's activities. Maybe there's some opportunity for partnering there. The subcommittee that is meeting on sustainability, I mean, that's a big challenge for all of these kind of public good type activities. I have a lot of experience with that as former dean of the School of Information and trying to sustain our Internet Public Library, which is a great, great resource, but there's no tax base, local tax base, to keep it going. So maybe you can continue to be a pilot project and a case study and maybe an example of best practice from which others can learn in your attempt to create a multi-stakeholder model of sustainability. And I think there's still work to be done on evaluating the impact that your NSDL is having and sharing what you've learned with the rest of the world, including most particularly this emerging open educational resources community. And I think that's all I had planned to say. So if we have more time, the floor is open. Thank you.
Does this work? I'll just be loud. Thanks, Dan. Very stimulating set of remarks. So ahead of time, several folks submitted some questions. And so I thought I'd maybe just pick one of those to get things rolling. But then I hope this morning you've been jotting some notes down, and perhaps Dan's specific remarks have sparked some additional questions. So I'll stall for you if you're trying to write furiously your question down. But let me pose this first one. There's a preamble here, but the context is that cyber infrastructure has enormous potential to support new kinds of educational approaches and practices. And the questioner is asking to really reach or asserting that to really reach this potential for change requires much more than just incremental reform of education, something much larger. So the questions are, how do we rethink teaching content, assessment, and student-teacher relationships? How do we include computers, digital data, and networks to change traditional education? And can you propose how we develop richer and more instructionally sound computational environments? So it's perhaps an opportunity
what
to...
What was the last phrase?
Can you propose how we develop richer and more instructionally sound computational environments?
Mm-hmm. Well, someone's giving me a lot of credit for knowing a lot. I'm really not come out of the education field. I think, as I implied in my slides, that this open education movement, open learning movement, I think, where we augment the more authority-based, institutionally-based learning with open resources of all sort that hopefully would, in some sense, recreate for example, in my life, I grew up in an era in which ham radios and Heath kits and tinkering and amateurism and, you know, built my own tape recorder from scratch, including working with an older friend to learn how to operate a lathe and build a capstan and so forth. And that had a great effect on my passion for science and engineering and the trajectory in life that I took. I think we have the opportunity to reproduce some of that on a larger scale, and to honor, as I said, passion-based, amateur-based learning, and as an augmentation. So let me just repeat that. And I think that would represent some of the kind of discontinuous thinking that the question is implying. I must say I'm optimistic with the reputation of the new head of EHR coming in, your new boss, that she will be amenable to convening some of these more transformational events. And I, of course, don't have responsibility for very much of the educational agenda, but in this role of kind of this catalysis role that OCI has, we will quite willingly work with EHR and all the other directorates. And there's a passion for doing something about education across the entire foundation. It's not restricted to the directorate that Lee comes from. And so that some of these bolder notions, I think, that are implied in that question might be addressed in that context. In terms of providing computational environments, the NSF is now investing in two major grid initiatives. One, the TerraGrid, which is really intended to be the highest performance grid, and the other is the Open Science Grid, which is more of a peer-to-peer kind of Condor-based environment that allows many people to share their computational resources for the collective good, and it gives growing numbers of people access to computational rates that they couldn't get by themselves. And then finally, in both cases, and maybe particularly in the TerraGrid, the science gateway movement creates a lower barrier to entry and shields more and more people from all the messy underlying details and aggregates more and more functionally complete sets of resources that can be used by more and more people, not just the specialists. And so I think the science gateway movement is a very important part of the overall broadened participation and access from education strategy.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Are there any questions that have come to mind here? Dean? Sure, I think so. We're trying to capture this for posterity.
As we get into much more open contribution of educational resources, there's a huge trust issue as to, you know, what can I count on, what authority do I rely on?
Yeah.
How do we resolve it? I mean, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Yeah, I have some thoughts on it. I think it may have said on my slides, but I should have further emphasized is that that I'm talking about quality education resources. And if you look at if you go, for example, to the Hewlett OER website, you'll see a lot of emphasis on their aspiration for providing quality open learning educational resources to the world. Well, they did that initially by going to a pre-branded place, MIT, and a lot of the other members now that have joined the Open Educational Resources Consortium, you know, have that kind of pre-branding. So that was kind of an easy way to start. But that's one of the things I find very intriguing about the pathway structure that you've put together here, that you have that embedded in that is kind of an authentication, credentialing, and organizing role, where there's these kind of large and growing and enormously big sets of kind of raw ingredients, and then various organizations in various disciplines are stepping forward to organize, sanction, and so forth. I think in the longer term, there's this idea that the internet is that information need not necessarily be pre-credentialed and distributed through the internet. It can its use in the internet can be credentialing. The kind of social life information idea. And so I think as we go forward, I mean, this is a very central idea, so I'm a requirement, and so I'm very glad you brought it up. We can think about reputation strategies. We can think reputation system strategies. We can think about new forms of, I think, increasingly open peer review, a la the experiment going on at Nature right now. We can think of borrowing ideas from the open source software community, which are these kind of social technical structures that, in some sense, converge to good. Now, of course, in the software, particularly operating system Linux world, they have a kind of figure of merit that it runs better or it somehow is more efficient. So, but finding that for more generally for educational optics is a difficult thing. So I think there are a spectrum of approaches to the task you bring up. There's some kind of obvious ones building on kind of legacy structures, and I think there will be new ones emerging that and facilities for credentialing from the best bubbling up need to be part of the architectural designs of these open support systems.
Interesting. Thank you. Yes, Carl. Or get the microphone to walk to you.
That means I
have
to need to unload all the stuff on my lap.
Is there another question?
There we go. There's a mobile mic. Hi.
About this one.
Trying my memory of what I was going to ask you at this point. Changed it. One of the things is we talked about new opportunities for education. You've talked a little bit about data. You and I have talked about data provenance. One of the things I was wondering is cyber infrastructure, OCI's commitment or interest in new forms of scholarly communication, which also includes new forms of disseminating scholarly information for education, and how that possibly clashes with and interleaves with the interest of publishers. I know it's a sensitive issue here, in that a lot of these new forms have open access with big underlines around them, and there's some sensitivity about that. So I was wondering what your thoughts were on that, because there's some real opportunities here, as you probably know. I'm sure you know.
Yeah. I don't recall, I don't know, Chris, whether you do or not, whether there is any mention in the CI Vision document of new modes of scholarly communication, or if the term scholarly communication is used there or not. There is certainly a kind of a implicit, if not explicit, commitment to open source and open access and so forth in the whole kind of gestalt of the CI Vision document. And there will probably emerge over the coming years policy discussions about expectations or requirements for depositing the results of federally funded work. It's going on, of course, in other places, and probably will be surfacing more within the NSF community. The concept of data and data stewardship and curation, the term data, we're using in a very broad term. And we're also opening up the possibility that responses in that area would, for example, address systems in which you could link and preserve not only data sets but computational objects that operated on those data sets, and the scholarly papers in which that was cited and used. So we're talking about not just flat files of numbers by any means, but richly linked digital objects of all sort that are worthy of temporal interoperability, as Margaret Hedstrom often says. I don't think we have any particular aspirations to take on the publishing community directly, but that might be a byproduct of some of this activity.
Interesting. Yes, question in the back there. Bev, is that you?
Hi. I've liked your remarks, and I'm really excited about CI infrastructure. But I'm worried about education, because a lot of what I see being done is imitating what already exists in the classroom. You know, the teacher still has the authority. The student learns according to what the teacher says, and everybody is in tune and in step. So CI infrastructure offers the possibility of what you were talking about, the amateurism of people going off and doing something for weeks or years and coming to an end when they think they have an end. So what do we do to take this, you know, thing that moves at a glacial pace and get it to change into take advantage of what's out there? And, you know, do we wait till the present generation leaves, till the next generation comes? How do we see this change happening?
Well, I really need to throw that question back to you, but the only comment I'll make is that in my experience as kind of being a change agent in several contexts, including, for example, creating the School of Information at Michigan, which has given rise to the, among others, to this iSchool movement, you can't take on the center. You have to do interesting things at the edges and then hope that those will then propagate into the center. And I think the same obtains here. So it might be that some of the things I'm suggesting around passion-based, open learning, and so forth need to be addressed in the name of informal learning. And then maybe they would migrate in into more mainstream. It was interesting, though, there's this recent National Academy NRC report on science education in the K-8. Were some of you involved in creating that, or you're aware of it? And there was a briefing given at NSF on that recently. And one of the many interesting things about that was, one is that based on psychology and learning theory and so forth, it again re-emphasized the need and the importance of authentic project-based learning. But it also has a chapter, which I haven't read in detail yet, that asserts that it is quite possible to do project-based learning that also leads to appropriate achievement within standards-based outcome assessments. So maybe those aren't quite as in tension as some people seem to think. So I think working at the edges, trying to change the center from the edges, is just kind of the general answer I can give you to that.
Other questions? Anything? Let me then sort of shift gears a little bit, and we have a little bit more time. This is a more, I guess, a more practical kind of question about plans that OCI has to help principal investigators formulate cyber infrastructure components for proposals they submit. Are there some practical sort of steps that the office will undertake to help PIs understand what cyber infrastructure is and help shape their proposals?
Well, on the first part about helping understand what cyber infrastructure is, I mean, someone said that my report, the so-called Atkins report, is actually a Rorschach test, and that people can find in it what they will. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So, what cyber infrastructure is, of course, you can get at least some views of that from the various documents that I've cited today. And I think you need to read those. And, I'm trying to do my part through talks like this to at least give some approximation of what NSF thinks it's doing in this arena. The program officers at NSF are always available to meet with prospective grant seekers or resource seekers, and it's part of our job. And So I think you just have to come up with ideas, try to create some white papers, and schedule interactions. But again, there is a lot of material on the NSF website. I mean, not just the OCN. There are lots of resources there, and I think people in general don't spend enough time browsing through those. By all means, people with specific ideas they want to get some reaction to should get in touch with make some guess about what part of NSF might be interested in, and go for a conversation.
Yeah, I think I just thought of something. Let me just throw this out. I would add that, one, that the opportunities for cyber infrastructure exist throughout the foundation.
Yeah.
So. And I know that many of you are connected to NSF, not just through NSDL, but through your research efforts in the disciplinary areas. So you'd certainly want to look at that. But it occurs to me that I thought to myself as you were answering there, Dan, what NSDL might do to help spread the word.
Yeah.
And get the message out. And so here's an idea for those of you for whom it would fall in your lap. Perhaps some we can use the NSDL infrastructure to support some webcasts, some online seminars. Some of that is already going on. Dave, where are you? Yaron, tool time, speakers. Maybe we can do something of that nature, incorporate that in there. And then what we would need to rely on is all of you to get the word out to your communities, not just your NSDL communities, but your the multiple communities that you're involved in, to make them aware of these kinds of opportunities, either specific events that we schedule and announce, or other opportunities that are available. So, I mean, I think that's a natural kind of pairing that we should
explore. Yeah,
should
I agree with that.
Other questions? Let's see. People are probably just dying for some coffee, I think. Why don't we wrap up the session? You just follow the schedule for the next sort of thing. One more comment, by the way, about Second Life. You might know Congress is holding hearings about tax implications. And, money's green. So, but interestingly enough, there was a report just last night in the Times that the chair of the particular committee that's looking at this has publicly stated he doesn't think there should be taxation on virtual economies yet, right? I mean, that, because the current law doesn't say anything about that. But, there are companies that are going out there real companies and are doing product testing in Second Life. Have some coffee. Thank you.
Whoever borrowed this USB port.
Can we thank Dan, please, again?
All right, I have the enviable position of being the person between you and coffee at the moment, but I do have just a couple of quick housekeeping things. First of all, thank you very much again to Dr. Atkins and to Lee and to the others who spoke this morning. I also can't emphasize enough how appreciative we are of AAAS and the role that they've played in making this meeting possible, not only through the facilities, but also their staff has been just tremendous in terms of helping us plan. So for all those, I would like to give another round of applause. This is also a good moment to acknowledge the work of the Planning Committee, which is a group of volunteers from the different standing committees and from the community at large. And this is a group that is very hardworking. We meet weekly all year long, and they put a lot of their own personal time as well as time from their projects into the planning of this meeting. And then there's an additional group of folks who volunteered, you and the audience among them, to review the proposals that came through for sessions. And so, again, to acknowledge that this meeting is very much a community effort and to thank everyone for that. So two just sort of logistics things. One is that when it comes time for lunch, lunch will be served out in the hallway there where you came in. But because this auditorium, we're not supposed to have food or beverage in here, the Sustainability Standing Committee is scheduled to meet in this room immediately following the opening of the lunch buffet. So if you are someone who is coming to the Sustainability Planning Committee or committee meeting, if you could let those folks get first in line for lunch, that would they would probably really appreciate that, so they have a chance to eat before they come in here for their meeting. And then finally, you'll see on the schedule that tomorrow from 12:15 to 1:30, after we've had our lively panel discussion about sustainability, we'll have lunch available again. And then over lunch, there will be what are listed in your program as bird of a feather discussion groups. The intention that the Planning Committee have for those is to leave that space open for the moment for emerging issues and topics of interest that come up over today or from the poster session last night or whatever. So this is your opportunity to propose a bird of a feather group if there's a hot topic that you'd like to have more discussion around. There will be a sheet that will show up at the registration desk just outside the door here where you can propose a session for that time period tomorrow. And then also if you're interested in attending those, please check that list, and we're asking folks to sort of vote for which one they think they might be interested in attending just because we have a limited number of rooms for those groups to meet in. So that's how we'll organize those, and we'll publish tomorrow morning, also at the registration desk. We'll have available for you to see what those sessions will be and in what rooms. So we'll be gathering ideas for those all day today. And with that, have a great meeting. Thanks again.